people.
Okay, great. Thanks, Lars. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, and I'm part of something called the Joint Quantum Institute with the University of Maryland College Park Physics Department. The Joint Quantum Institute does interesting quantum things. And I would like to talk a little bit about what our program is doing, which is fundamental science and various applications with very, very cold molecules, ultra-cold molecules, we call them. And I title this talk Quantum Encounters of the Cold Kind because, first of all, we're down where things get very cold, and I'll have to explain what that's all about, and I'll have to explain what this quantum encounter business is, which basically molecules, or atoms for that matter, bounce into each other and collide, and we can control those collisions and interactions with very high precision. So, I'd just like to mention that kind of the topics that we're be working on, and I'm going to try to be fairly simple here. I'm not going to go into a lot of technicalities. I'm going to do a blackboard talk and explain what's going on in this field. But basically, a lot of what's going on is related to things that happened. And I'd just like to comment that the NIST Physics Laboratory has 4 Nobel Prizes in the last since 1997, and all of them are in some way related to the kind of work going on in this workshop, or at least in some sense. We had 1997, Bill Phillips won the prize along with Steve Chu, the experimentalist and theorist Claude Cohen-Tanucci, for their work in developing laser cooling, which is a way to get atoms very, very cold by using light. I'm not going to try to explain how laser cooling works. In 2001, Eric Cornell at NIST in Boulder, and along with Carl Wieman and Wolfgang Ketterle, Wieman at University of Colorado and Ketterle at MIT, achieved in 1995 the phenomenon of Bose-Einstein condensation, which was predicted in 1924 by Einstein and essentially had not been realized until that point. A lot of people have been working on it up to then. Helium films basically are, if they're films, they're 2D. If they're 3D, you get a helium, liquid helium sometimes is looked at as a Bose-Einstein condensate, but my understanding is that basically the helium is so strongly interacting that the condensate is strongly depleted. So the concept of helium as a Bose-Einstein condensate is quite old. And so these atomic systems that they got at that time are essentially very dilute systems that really are pretty much 100% Bose-Einstein condensate.
Helium and black hole is also.
It's also that way. Okay. I'm less familiar with the helium, so if I need to stand corrected on any of this, just let me know, because helium is a great thing. Precision measurements, Jan Hall at NIST in Boulder, along with Ted Hinch, Roy Glauber, some of the technology they developed, the frequency combs, in fact, are used in making cold molecules. But precision measurement is a very important aspect of this whole field. Do the fundamental constants change in time? How precisely can we measure things? Atomic clocks are the best way to make precise measurements. We can get something on the order of now 17 digits of accuracy with very precise atomic clocks in measuring time and frequency. And finally, the recent prize, Dave Wineland, for his work particularly with individual quantum systems involving trapped ions, where you can take a charged particle, charged atom, and trap it in a ion trap, maybe several of them, and you can interact them. Maybe you can use these for interesting quantum bits for doing quantum information and things like that. So, cold atoms have been worked at for now maybe 25 years. Cold molecules are much newer, maybe something in the vicinity of a decade, a little more, a little less, depending on what you're talking about, and are catching up with the atoms. So we're looking at many of the same kinds of things. What do I mean by cold? Well, here's a thermometer scale in powers of 10, a log scale, so from 10 to the 9th Kelvin to a picokelvin. So room temperature is up here around 300 Kelvin, chemistry is in this scale. The interior of the sun is up here about 20 million Kelvin. When you change by powers of 10, things really begin to get dramatically different. So if we can go down in temperature by many, many, maybe 9, 10, 12 orders of magnitude, powers of 10, then interesting things certainly begin to happen. liquid helium is sitting around here in this region. All that is enormous amount of work done and with liquid helium and helium in films and surfaces and so forth. Laser cooling typically gets us down into below a millikelvin, into the microkelvin range perhaps. And another kind of cooling, which is called evaporative cooling, it simply means you have trapped atoms, you lower the trap depth, the hot atoms go away, sample gets colder, you lose a few atoms, but yet you can get Bose-Einstein condensation, which gets us certainly below the microkelvin down into the nanokelvin domain. So if you prefer energy scales and electron volts, then we basically down here, we're down the picoelectron volt scale, so it's very tiny. And sometimes we prefer to divide energy by Planck's constant to convert things to frequencies. And so basically you go from terahertz down to kilohertz. So the kind of like the kilohertz frequency scale, the millisecond time scale is kind of well matched to this ultra-cold domain that we get into. Now molecules are beginning to get into this regime. Now molecules are very different from atoms. They have different structure. Laser cooling basically works off the fact that we have two energy levels, E1 and E2, and you can tune a photon very close to the transition. The light can exert forces on atoms, and we'll go into the details of how laser cooling works, but basically by scattering photons, you can slow down atoms and cool them. And atoms are very simple, two-level structure like this, although there's a little subtlety here, because atoms like sodium and rubidium that they cool have spin, unpaired electron spin and nuclear spin, and so there's a little bit of hyperfine structure here you have to account for, and that can be done. Molecules are much richer. They, in some ways, they have a whole set of vibrational levels, and each one of those will have some rotational structure. I'm not really drawing anything to scale here. So they have a much more complex structure that also makes them very hard to laser cool, because if they absorb light and re-emit light, you populate lots of levels and you just can't keep scattering the same photon over and over again. So you really can't laser cool molecules. There are a few exceptions. In fact, there's just a very few molecules now where laser cooling looks like it's going to work very well and it can be done for them. But there's very few species for which this is likely to be true. It's not a general method. You might try to slow molecules down and decelerate them, and people have been building molecule decelerators now for a while. For example, molecules have dipole moments. You can develop an electric field-based decelerator that'll bring molecules to a standstill. But they're still at very low density, and we need to get them colder. And there's a whole bunch of issues about molecules. Some very interesting news on that. There was just in December in Nature, Jun Yi's group at JILA published a paper showing that they were actually got some evaporative cooling to lower the phase space density of OH radicals, which are kind of normal chemical kinds of things, OH molecules, down to in the vicinity of a millikelvin using evaporative cooling. So there's some good prospects that some of that technique may come along. But if you want to get really, really cold into this microkelvin, sub-microkelvin domain, the best way now is to take two atoms that you've already made cold and get them to stick together and make your cold molecule that way. And by doing that, and I'll tell you a little bit about how they get there, that's part of what we'll be looking at. We have one molecule that's around, KRB molecule, and it's actually potassium 40, rubidium 87, and it's they have about 40,000 molecules, and they can get them down to around 200 nanokelvin. And these aren't going to Bose condense, and probably some of you can immediately tell me why, but I'll tell you, this is a potassium 40 is a fermion, it's not a boson. If you stick a rubidium 87 boson together with this fermion, you have a fermionic molecule. So fermions don't Bose condense, they do Fermi-type things rather than Bose-type things. So that gets us to another aspect of this very, very low energy world that we're thinking about, where the differences between bosons and fermions is quite significant. So first of all, if we think, let's just think Bose-Fermi, and You know, if most anybody in physics here knows, I'm sure, what the difference is. But let me just go through it. Bosons have integer spins like 0, 1, 2, etc. And fermions have half odd integer spins like 1 half, 3 halves, 5 halves, etc. And they have very different properties. You can put any number of bosons you like in a single quantum state. That's essentially what Bose-Einstein condensation is. You get a sample of very cold atoms cold enough, they all go into a single quantum state, which has some very special properties. The atoms essentially become all coherent across the whole sample and do very interesting matter wave type things. You can even do four-wave mixing of matter waves using Bose-Einstein condensates. There's all kinds of exotic things you can do with condensates. There's a lot of research in that area, but fermions are different. If one good example, by the way, one atom that people like to cool is lithium. Lithium is hydrogen-like. Remember, it's three electrons, one electron is outside the closed S shell, and so you have that one unpaired electron. But you get two kinds of lithium, lithium-6 and lithium-7. Well, lithium-7 is a boson, and lithium-6 is a fermion. And if you cool down a gas of lithium-6 and lithium-7, there's a very nice picture of this in Science from somewhere back around 2000 and so, from a group that did this. You find the Bose sample, and you're going to get down below a microkelvin in the nanokelvin range, just collapses down and gets smaller and smaller and smaller. The Fermi sample simply stops collapsing because of Fermi pressure. It simply holds up. So you just immediately see in the images of these clouds the differences between bosons and fermions because of their properties. You can't put two fermions in the same quantum state. So that's the basic Aufbau principle by which we put electrons in atoms and build up basic atomic structure in the periodic table, because electrons are fermions. Okay, so that's one thing. The clouds that you can get of these very cold atoms are typically, well, I said here they had 40,000 molecules. The atoms, you can typically get a few hundred thousand to a million atoms. You can put them, when you cool them down to these very cold temperatures, they can be put into a trap. Well, let's see, how do we trap atoms? Well, I'll tell you in a moment, but you're confining these in a little atom trap, maybe a few tens of microns on a side. Maybe they're not necessarily all spherical. You could have them maybe a few 10, 20 microns across and maybe 100 microns long. You can put a few million atoms in that. You get, and Bose-Einstein condensation basically happens when you get 2.6 or more atoms per cubic de Broglie wavelength. The number of atoms per cubic de Broglie wavelength is called phase space density. When the phase space density reaches 2.6, you can have a Bose-Einstein condensate. So I mentioned de Broglie wavelength. So of course, one of the things about getting cold is that we mean here translationally cold, so the velocity goes down. The atoms, all the molecules that we're working with, get very much slower. They're moving slower. So the de Broglie wavelength is just inversely related to the momentum. The momentum is the product of the mass and the velocity. So as they get slower and slower and slower, the de Broglie wavelength gets very much bigger. So if you get down in here at a nanokelvin, if I take a particle with 100 atomic mass units as its weight, I mean, it'll vary with the molecule. If you take potassium rubidium, that's 40 and 87. You can add that up and get 127. So that's the mass of potassium rubidium. So I just took this as a typical example. We basically get down to the vicinity of a micron or 1,000 nanometers or more when we get to a nanokelvin for particles of that weight, and it's more like a nanometer or so if we're up around a millikelvin. So the de Broglie wavelength gets very, very large, almost macroscopic. So that's one of the ways in which these particles get quantum. Remember now, chemical bond is not so big. It's more like a few hundred picometers. or a few, you know, a few Bohr radii, something like that. So it's not very big. So these de Broglie wavelengths get enormously large compared to the size of a chemical bond. So if two atoms come together or two molecules come together and collide, they have this enormous de Broglie wavelength, and that modifies the way in which they get together. We can control that very precisely. That's part of the beauty of this whole world here. But we'll get into that in a moment. Let's just think about energy, kinetic energy, potential energy, because you can shape what's going on with these very cold atoms and molecules, and that's one of the more important things that you can do with them. Let's think of it for a moment. You know, this terrain around Santa Barbara is pretty good, actually, because, you know, you got the flat ocean, you got the land, it's kind of flat, and then it waves a little bit, and then you get the mountains, and it goes up, you know. So if you take a hike from the ocean up the mountains, you're increasing your potential energy, and if you come to a cliff and jump off, your kinetic energy goes up, and so there's a balance between potential and kinetic energy. So just to get you thinking about these kind of things, there's some kind of landscape that these atoms are, and the question is, are we going to control that landscape with things like light and magnetic fields and stuff like that? So that's one of the really neat things, because the energy scale doesn't have to be very big to exert fairly profound control over what's going on here. So,
can you comment on the stability of these condensates?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good point. Condensates, of course, you know that if you had a lump of the first thing that was condensed was rubidium or sodium. If you had a lump of rubidium at 0 degrees Kelvin, it's a hunk of solid. These are metastable, and they typically have lifetimes on the order of tens of seconds. Sometimes it depends on the density, but basically, if you take, that's a good point in relating to your potential energy here, because of course the energy, if you have collision of two particles, energy is conserved, so they come together, collide, speed up, and go back apart again. So when they come together, the only thing they can do if they have elastic collisions is just bounce off each other and go back apart. On the other hand, what happens if they come together and they stick and make a diatomic molecule? Well, you can't do that with two particles, but you can with three, because this thing can come together, and while they're together, a third particle comes in, bang, hits it, releases it, then it can kind of knock it down into a bound state of the dimer system. That actually happens, three-body recombination. That's what controls the lifetime of these condensates. So essentially what you have is a very cold metastable gas. The densities of these gases are something like, if you take 1 million atoms and you put them in a volume of a few tens of microns, it depends on whether how many and what the volume is, but typical numbers for fermions or more dilute gases are 10 to the 12th particles per cubic centimeter up to about 10 to the 15th particles per cubic centimeter. And the three-body recombination rate, these are very dilute gases, of course, so the three-body recombination rate typically is long enough. Three-body recombination rate, though, varies quite a bit from species to species. Some species are much easier to work with than others in that regard. So rubidium turns out to be extremely favorable with respect to three-body recombination, one of the reasons they got to Bose-Einstein condensation. Cesium, which is another gas, is absolutely terrible for three-body recombination. Is people worked with cesium for a long time and never could get it to condense. Cesium and rubidium, they're both group one in the periodic table. They got one electron outside a closed shell. They're kind of hydrogen-like in that regard. They're doublet S atoms. And totally, totally different properties. The reason is because they have different scattering lengths. When the scattering length gets very big, the recombination rate gets very large. So I'm going to tell you what a scattering length is, but not yet, so we'll get there. Any other questions on any of this? Okay, good. Well, I was telling about the kinetic and potential energies. Well, the atoms are mostly, magnetic fields can grab hold of the magnetic moments of the atoms and hold them, or you can use light, focus a laser beam down into a fairly small volume. that polarizes the atoms. It shifts their energies just a little bit. So if you think of a potential energy like this, you would have in space, where the light's focused, the energy is going to go down. So you can put the atoms down in this little potential well. So you can trap them. So you can make an atom trap by focused light. It's called a dipole trap. They're very commonly used. These molecules that I was telling you about of the KRB are held in these optical dipole traps like that. It's a very effective way of holding atoms. Now, the light shifts aren't very big, of course, because the depth of this potential, it might only be a few microkelvin. But if you have your atoms at a few hundred nanokelvin, it's not too hard to keep them in a trap like that. So that's the kind of energy scale you get by using ordinary laboratory lasers focused down. But it gets more interesting than that, and that's one of the reasons I think atoms and molecules have generated a lot of interest. I mean, this shows how the field begins to get multidisciplinary, because we see all the people interested in condensed matter issues like fermions and bosons and how these gases behave at low temperature, these quantum gases. That's interesting, but you can do something else with them, because you can take your light that would make a potential energy. And if you have two counterpropagating laser beams, you make a standing wave in space. So basically, if I plotted the light intensity versus space, then basically I'd get something that looked like a sine wave. And this could go on for maybe 100 or so oscillations, typically, in some of these traps. The spacing between these minima would be, well, I'll just write down the expression. If we have we'd have a potential term here that would look something like some depth of the potential times sine squared of KLX, where X would be the distance along this way. This is 2 pi over the wavelength of light, the wave vector of light. So basically, you get this nice pattern in space, periodic structure you can write in space. It's called an optical lattice. Back in the early 90s, people at NIST began to develop optical lattices, and other places too, but there's a lot of work at NIST going on with optical lattices, as well as a lot of other laboratories. Well, the depth of these optical lattices can typically be on the order of a microkelvin or a few microkelvin, and you can control them by how intense the light is, because the intensity of light controls this. The distance between here would be the wavelength of light over 2. And not only that, because these energy levels in these lattices are quantized, so you could have one or two or more levels. And since the levels up here these tunnel fairly rapidly, this might actually make a band that's got some bandwidth to it. And this would have a little bandwidth, but it'd be a little narrow. Atoms can tunnel from here to here to here. And so we basically can engineer these kind of lattice structures with almost solid state like Brillouin's own structure. And you can put one atom in one of these things. And now, I've shown if you have a counterpropagating light in two directions, what's possible. You can take laser beams along this direction, the orthogonal direction, and the vertical direction. You have 6 laser beams, and you can actually confine these things in space. I brought along my one little prop here, which my egg carton. So, I mean, an optical lattice is kind of like you can put an atom in one of these things, and people can actually write, just imagine this thing reproduced, lattice structure going several this way, several that way, several stacked on top of each other. So now we have a little lattice we've written in space, put one atom in each lattice site. Well, you may or may not get one atom in each lattice site, or molecule. We're also thinking of doing this with molecules. This is done routinely in labs now with these lattices. If you could put a superfluid in a lattice, and if the lattice is not very deep, the quantum superfluid just kind of can be distributed over the whole lattice. If you turn the depth up a little bit, then you find you have, can have a quantum phase transition. So from a quantum superfluid to a Mott insulator. The Mott insulator would localize one atom per site, whereas in a superfluid, the atoms are free to wander throughout all the sites. They tunnel quite rapidly. So there's all kinds of interesting things people can do with these kinds of lattices. One of the best ways to make molecules, and people are still trying to realize this in practically, if you want to make a whole molecule, would be to take an atom, put it in the lattice, and get another atom of a different species that you want to make a two-atom molecule out of, and get them to hop onto the same lattice sites. Now you have precisely two atoms per lattice site, and you can do some fairly simple manipulations that coax these atoms to bond together into a molecule. That's a very interesting thing. That's, in fact, how we would actually like to make molecules very effectively. In fact, if we go back, it was in 2003, I believe, that I did a paper with Peter Zoller. I think Peter's often been here and done some workshops here. He did a workshop here a few years ago on strongly correlated matter, which in fact involves atoms and quantum gases and lattices, as well as other kinds of things. But you can take these many-body systems that you can engineer and make them do some very interesting things, and then begin to study how ensembles of atoms behave collectively. What are their many-body properties? What are their condensed matter properties? And so it's precisely that ability to engineer these lattices very carefully with atoms and hopefully molecules that are very interesting. This is where atoms and molecules are different, because atoms typically only contact each other when they're right next to each other, because these are neutral atoms, they're not ions. They only have, since they're neutral particles, they have weak long-range forces. They're van der Waals forces. Van der Waals forces are very moderately short-range. They vary as the sixth power of the distance between the particles. So we get these very long-range forces, but only are operative when the atoms are within a few nanometers of each other. This confinement dimension here that you're confined in, the spacing is the spacing here between the governed by the wavelength of light, and for visible light, which is typically used, 6,000 nanometer light, 500 nanometer light, 600 nanometer light. You know, these distances are a few, 200 or 300 nanometers typically. So we're talking about cells spaced apart by a few hundred nanometers. The confinement within this confined ground state is typically maybe 30 to 50 nanometers. So we have the atoms confined in a small volume, and but they only contact each other when they're closer together than just a few nanometers. Dipoles, on the other hand, if we take a molecule like potassium rubidium, has a dipole moment. There's a separation of positive and negative charge. Potassium rubidium, although I have to say that if you take a molecule and it's simply sitting there in free space in a rotational eigenstate, it's in a state of pure rotation. Molecules, they might have a body frame dipole, but they're rotating in a rotational eigenstate. They have no space frame dipole. But you can cause them to pick up a dipole by turning on an electric field. The electric field tends to line those up. So we have electric field control over these dipoles. You can line them up, so they're lined up all in one direction. Now these dipoles begin to interact with each other through long-range forces that vary as the inverse cube of the distance, and that's very much longer. So on the length scale that we have, this dipole, these two pairs of atoms were converted into a molecule in here so that they were bound up in the vibrational ground state of the molecule, then basically we could get a very strong dipole, and a dipole here could talk to a dipole here, maybe even over here. So we have these long-range forces. And in fact, it was Peter Zoller and his group who nearly 7 or 8 years ago started talking a lot about dipoles, because if you could realize dipoles, you could realize all sorts of interesting spin Hamiltonians in these types of lattice structures. So that's a condensed matter issue that I'm not a condensed matter theorist, so I can't tell you about all the details about that, but a lot of people at this workshop are working on those kind of things. So what we have to do, we have to, in order to understand these coal molecules, we have to understand a whole range of things, from how do we take atoms and get them together to make molecules, or if we have a molecule, how could we actually slow it down? What kind of collisions does it have? And good collisions or bad collisions, because molecules can react and go away. That's something different from atoms. And if we want to be able to control them, then we have to be able to understand those kind of things. So we need to understand the way they interact with each other. Now, I think the interactions between the atoms and molecules are very, very interesting. And molecules are different from atoms. And the beauty of the ultra-cold world is that we can control those interactions with very exquisite and very high precision. And let me show you how that happens. And I need to tell you then a little bit about these what I call the quantum encounters. And actually, I'm going to use a model that goes back to Hans Bethe in 1935. He used exactly the same model to explain thermal neutrons colliding off nuclei, where they had very cold neutrons. Cold neutrons basically meant that the de Broglie wavelength of the neutrons was enormous compared to the size of the nucleus that they were scattering off of. So the picture, there's nothing new basically in quantum threshold phenomena. It goes back a long, long way. What's new is our ability to realize it with a variety of atoms and molecules to control that very, very precisely. And if we can control that, then we have these atoms and molecules that we can use for engineering very exotic, strongly correlated quantum systems, and studying condensed matter physics and so forth and so on. So, Bethe basically just assumed the nucleus was some kind of a box, so the potential energy curve was just the potential energy between two particles. If this is the distance between the particle coming in, the neutron coming in, and that's a nucleus. There's a box in here, and so then the neutron going out, that when they're far apart, is just basically, it's not interacting with the nucleus, so it just has constant potential energy. And if it goes in, then there's a big box in here that it can fall into. So it's out here, this distance range out here, there's this enormously long de Broglie wavelength, very large compared to the size of this little box. It's even kind of hard to draw these things. The difference in sizes gets so different. And so there's stuff that goes on in here associated with the size of this box, and then there's the long de Broglie wavelength. In the box in here, the energy is very large. The kinetic energy is very large because you converted this potential energy into kinetic energy. And so that means the atoms, whether it's a neutron and a nucleus or whether it's two atoms coming together, they're moving very fast in here. So they have a very, very rapid variation in their de Broglie wavelength gets very short, gets very small, because this is a very high energy scale, where it's very long out here. And so what Bethe did basically was to figure out how to make the connection between this very, very long de Broglie wavelength and this very, very short one. And that gives us what we call the quantum standard quantum threshold formulas. This then basically, he was interested in reactions rather than elastic scattering or scattering lengths per se. So let me tell you what a scattering length is. If we simply had no interaction at all between two particles, then I would just draw my sine wave. Let's just draw the distance between, here's the wave function. So that's the wave function, that's zero. And so the wave function's coming in. If I had no interaction at all, I really should start this at zero here, and then it would go out and oscillate. And we basically would have a wave function that's just a sine of K, I'll call that K associated with the de Broglie wavelength. R is the distance between the particles, and K is just 2 pi over lambda de Broglie wavelength. So, so basically, we have this sine wave. Now, when the atoms are very close together here, now I'm talking about two atoms or two molecules colliding, there's a potential that operates on the scale of chemical bonding lengths, which are very much smaller than nanometers, fraction of a nanometer. So when the particles are very close together, the wave function starts oscillating in here. It has a very small amplitude because you got to connect onto this thing, which is going down to zero. And what basically happens is, if you look at the wave out here, it gets a phase shift. It oscillates with a slightly different phase. And in fact, the way it works is it just becomes. It's as if the origin of the oscillation down here is a little different. It's phase shifted. So the phase shift basically is the negative of something that has units of length times A. This is called the scattering length. It's really a measure of a quantum mechanical phase. And you actually can push the phase out this way, pushing the atoms a little further apart. We call that a repulsive interaction and a positive scattering length. On the other hand, you can actually suck the wave function in a little bit closer. And that corresponds to a phase that has a negative scattering length. Now, that's interesting enough. Every atom has a different scattering length. If we look at two rubidium atoms coming together, they have a scattering length. If it's a rubidium 87, it's nominally order of a few nanometers, about 5 nanometers. If you look at rubidium 87, I'm sorry, I said rubidium 87 is about 5 nanometers. If you look at the other isotope of rubidium, rubidium 85, it has a scattering length of about minus 20 nanometers. It's negative. Well, you can't make a condensate with a negative scattering length. So you can't make a condensate of rubidium 85. But you can of rubidium 87. So this quantum phase property determines how these collections of bosons behave when you put them together. Because you make a mean field of the whole system that is proportional to the, turns out to be proportional to the magnitude and sign of the scattering length. So if you have a positive scattering length with an effective repulsive interaction that corresponds to like pushing the atoms a little further apart on the average, you don't really need to worry about the details of what goes on in here. All you have to worry about is how the phase gets moved. How the phase of this long de Broglie wavelength object gets moved. And that enables you to predict all kinds of properties of Bose-Einstein condensates. People do this routinely. And many different species have many different scattering lengths. So that's one thing that's important. This very long de Broglie wavelength of hundreds of nanometers, or even over 1,000 nanometers, compared to the chemical bonding length of less than a nanometer. And even the rate reach of the long range van der Waals potential is only a few nanometers, maybe 5, 4, 5, 6. So that's basically what's happening when you have these very cold quantum encounters, that you've got this shifting of phase. Now I'm talking about neutral atoms. Molecules might do something a little bit different because you have the dipoles. Dipoles can be rather different. But so the scattering length is an important quantity. We actually can change the scattering length, and that's part of the beauty of this, because these atoms, as well as molecules, of course, they have various internal degrees of freedom. A rubidium atom has electron, which is spin up, spin down possibility. There's also nuclear spin. So because the rubidium has a nuclear spin that can couple into the electron spin, and at least in the case of rubidium 87, that gives states of total angular momentum 1 and 2, and in the case of rubidium 85, total angular momentum states of 2 and 3. So you get this spin structure, this hyperfine structure, which you can control with the magnetic field. Well, it turns out it's possible to have another little box in here, which in effect can support bound states, which correspond to states with different spin structure, different magnetic moments. And these can be tuned with the magnetic field, so that as you tune the magnetic field, you can take one of these bound states and move it across threshold and tune it below, tune it above. Now, if you go to a real molecule, real system, you got to do it right and do the proper mixing between this bound state and the scattering state. These are called Feshbach resonances, and some people prefer to call them Fano Feshbach resonances after Feshbach wrote his famous papers in 1958. Of course, a lot of this resonance phenomena was known well before that. Fano did his paper in 1935 on resonances in electron atom scattering. And so essentially you have a bound state that can couple into a continuum. The bound state has a different character, a different magnetic moment in this case, than the separated atoms that are coming together. The same thing could apply to molecules as to atoms here, and I'm talking about atoms. So these Feshbach resonances, I put a few references down here, by the way. These are about molecules. The Reviews of Modern Physics one is an article on Feshbach resonances and using them to control quantum gases. What you basically find is that as you tune one of these resonances across threshold, the scattering length can be tuned to any value you like. If I plotted scattering length here with zero, and this is, I'm tuning magnetic field this way, and let's just suppose there's a magnetic field pole value is there where the scattering length is infinity. Let's take the, let's say there's some background scattering length that you have in the absence of such a resonance. That's just independent of the magnetic field. I can tune this bound state across threshold, and what you find is that you get a singularity that the scattering length can go arbitrarily large, arbitrarily small. Well, not arbitrarily, you're limited by the size of the de Broglie, well, the value of K, what the energy actually is, because K times the scattering length can't get much larger than something like a pi when this begins to break down. So K has to be small enough, depending on how large the scattering length is. But in practice, you can actually tune the scattering lengths, and for things like cesium, rubidium, lithium, these Feshbach resonances have been measured by many experimentalists. We have very good Hamiltonian models with all the gory details put into them for quantum scattering, and we can predict these properties, calculate properties of new unobserved resonances and so forth very well. So we understand these extremely well, and so you can control the interactions between these particles. And of course, if we go back to the lattice picture with the lattice bands, you can control the tunneling between sites by how deep you make the lattice. You can control the interactions between particles on the same lattice by the magnetic field if you have one of these Feshbach resonances. So there's been an enormous amount of work that's been done with these kind of systems in these Feshbachs. It's been very fruitful because you basically have a designer Hamiltonian where you are controlling your potential landscape with lattices, where you control interactions and you control the spacing and tunneling of sites. If you don't have a lattice and just have a gas, you still can control the interactions, and these quantum gases are very sensitive to the interactions. You can take a Bose-Einstein condensate at positive scattering length, tune the scattering length to zero. If you tune the scattering length to zero, the gas behaves essentially as a non-interacting gas and behaves very differently. In fact, one of the first experiments that was done with dipoles was not actually done with a molecule, it was done with an atom, the chromium atom, which, interestingly enough, can be Bose-cooled and down to make a Bose condensate of chromium. You know, it's a nice chrome-plated condensate, so kind of pretty. You know. No, that was a joke, so, okay. So the chromium has, you can use one of these Feshbach resonances in chromium to tune the scattering length to zero. Chromium has a very large magnetic dipole moment. It's about six times larger than for rubidium or cesium. And in fact, the dipole-dipole interaction between two chromium atoms then is fairly large. So what people have actually seen in the expansion of the Bose-Einstein condensate, if they just kind of turn off the trap and let it go, it expands in a dipolar-like way. So you can see the dipolar properties of the interactions. So now we have the possibility of looking at dipolar quantum gases. That's one of the reasons you want to get molecules, so we can look at dipolar superfluids or dipolar physics in these lattices or in these cold gases. So it promises to be a very very rich kind of physics. So that's a fairly simple explanation of hopefully what the scattering length is involved with. And how long do we go on this? I can keep going because I can tell you about chemistry. Tell you about what happens when cold molecules react. That's okay. We'll go through that part of it then. Because cold chemistry has been being explored. That's another theme in another area that I think is quite important. And we have people from the chemistry field at our workshop that's working on coal chemistry. So if we take these KRB molecules, and by the way, there are several labs around that are working on making other molecules. It's the group 1 atoms, potassium, rubidium, cesium, sodium, and so forth, are very easy to laser cool and are good subjects for these kind of systems. Some work going on at MIT right now with potassium sodium that looks very promising for making another dipolar molecule. And there's a group in Innsbruck working with rubidium-cesium mixtures trying to make molecules. And there are other kinds of molecules too, so hopefully we'll have other kinds of molecules to play with. Some of these are reactive and some of them are not. The potassium-rubidium molecule undergoes a chemical reaction. Two of those come together and they can make a potassium-2 molecule and a rubidium-2 molecule. It's not much energy release, but it does release energy. It's chemically reactive. If you had potassium with sodium, on the other hand, that's not chemically reactive, and to make a very interesting system, that's a different kind of system to look at. So, what happens about chemical reactions when you get down into this extremely cold domain? Well, these are fermions. If they're like fermions, they can only collide or interact if they have an odd relative angular momentum. We say a P wave, an odd orbital angular momentum. If they're bosons, or if they're unlike fermions, they can come together and interact with zero angular momentum, what we call an S wave. I've been describing S-wave collisions here, where the particles basically can come together at zero energy. There's no barriers of any kind. If you have finite angular momentum in the collision, the relative motion of the two particles, a P-wave, is well known for fermions, identical fermions, then essentially there's going to be a repulsive barrier at long range, a centrifugal barrier, and they can't get together. For rubidium potassium molecules, the centrifugal barrier is about 24 microkelvin high, the top of the barrier. The molecules are at 200 nanokelvin, so therefore the barrier is much higher and they can only get through that barrier by tunneling. So by taking identical fermions, and the way in which they get these molecules are molecules in their ground state. The molecules, the way they make the molecules, they take these two atoms in a gas. It's not in the lattice but in, that they did the experiment, but in a gas. They can use a magnetic field to just tickle the atoms and coax them together into an extremely weakly bound molecule. And then they use lasers, very highly coherent frequency comb locked lasers, in a two-color process through an excited state with one laser up, one laser down. The difference in frequency of those lasers is matched precisely. It's about one part, it's about a megahertz out of 400 terahertz binding energy that, 125 terahertz binding energy that that you match with the laser. So they get down and make vehicle zero vibrational ground state molecules. So they have these vibrationally ground state molecules. And they're also in their rotational ground state. And they put them in one particular spin state. You know, as I said, they have these atoms have nuclear spin, so there's actually 36 different possibilities for nuclear spin projection for a KRB molecule in its vibrational rotational ground state. So they're able to prepare it in one and only one of those spin states. So we have absolutely identical fermions. Well, the fermionic gas lives for order of a second or so, if it's down around 200 nanokelvin, the fermionic molecules can't react because of the centrifugal barrier. But if they flip a spin, and they can use microwaves to do that through the first excited rotational state, use a microwave process, they can take these fermions prepared in one particular state of nuclear spin and take half of them and put them in a different state of nuclear spin. So now we have two unlike fermions present because they have different nuclear spins. The reaction rate increases by about a factor of 100. They start reacting like gangbusters because now they can collide with an S-wave interaction. And what really controls the reaction rate, if we look at this potential landscape of two particles, two molecules coming together, the long range is, you got the short range part of a potential that's very deep, and then you got some kind of long range part of the potential. And out here in the long range part, you get a little barrier in the P wave, so if they're coming together very, very cold with a long de Broglie wavelength, they can't get together. If they're coming in with S waves, they can get in to short distance where they undergo chemistry and chemically react. So you're controlling this out here. Now, if you use an electric field, you actually can induce this dipole in the molecules, like I was telling you. So now you have molecules with dipoles with these 1/r³ long-range attractions. Well, repulsions or attractions. Remember, dipoles have, this is say the positive end, the negative end, the positive end, the negative end of two dipoles. If they come together like that, that's repulsive. But what if they come together like that? That's attractive. And if they're in a gas, they can come together however they like. So they're going to find each other this way and react. So that's what happens. If you turn on an electric field, remember now, if they no electric field, they're in rotational eigenstates, so they're not pointed. If you turn on the electric field, they get pointed, and they can always find each other. So even if they're alike in an electric field, the P wave barrier goes down, and the reaction goes way up for the P waves, for light fermions, by a factor of 50 or so. So it gets really fast. So turn on a little electric field, and these things start reacting. But you can control that too, because then we go back to our lattices. If I have counterpropagating light, let's just think of it, I'm going to think of it vertically here. Vertically, I have my regions of intense and weak light. So you basically make a stack of pancakes. You make little traps that are a stack of pancakes. The thickness of the pancakes is governed by the wavelength of light and the strength of the lattice. In the direction this way, the laser intensity kind of tapers off slowly to the edge of the laser beam that's making this light. So they're free to roam this way, but they're tightly confined, maybe to 30 or 50 nanometers in this vertical direction. Then you take your electric field and line them up. Well, they're just doing like this. They're constrained. So the only way they can react is they're repulsive at long range. And you've controlled by your dipole the strength of that repulsion. So essentially you can turn off the reactions with the electric field as long as you put them in these pancakes. It's been demonstrated experimentally at JELA. It works. And which was one of the reasons you can actually make stacks of these pancakes, which they're actually trying to do experimentally. And you have the molecules in this stack of pancakes. You got another stack up here. You can put them far enough apart so they can't tunnel from pancake to pancake. So here we have a set of fermions lined up like this. Here we have a set of fermions lined up like this. But they're dipoles, so they interact across the pancakes. So you can pair up the fermions and make a superfluid, bosonic superfluid, out of fermions that are moving in separate wells. I mean, this is the kind of thing experimentalists are trying to get to the point where they can realize these phenomena. The problem is it's still hard to work with these molecules. Molecules are behind the atoms. We're trying to get there. So the experimentalists don't have yet the density of molecules that would be commensurate with unit occupancy of lattice sites if we made a full 3D lattice and fill all these sites. They can put them in pancakes. They're still not quite dense enough, and they're still a little too hot, so they're trying to figure out how to get them colder. A lot of work being done in this right now. So hopefully what this workshop does is to bring together people that know something about chemistry and molecules and molecular properties and condensed matter people and people interested in precision measurement, so we can kind of put all this stuff together and see how to use and make these molecules. So that's all I need to say.
Okay, Paul.
Sure. Yes.
Does recombination come into play there?
With two per well, it's not an issue. You're thinking maybe the well could recombine them. Yes, it can be. He did a calculation of that a few years ago about the well as a third body and decided that the recombination rates were probably 2 or 3 orders of magnitude longer than the lifetime of the experiment. So basically, it didn't seem to be a problem. But it's a good question. because you have to actually look at it. Now, no one's seen that happen yet experimentally. So, three-body, I think, though, is a different matter. That you definitely, when you get the effective local density in one of these wells, is really, really high. And one of the things that hasn't been explored much in at all in detail is three-body phenomena, few-body phenomena in single wells. That's one of the things on the research agenda that I think needs addressing. And I think people are beginning to think about these things. You can, by the way, I didn't say anything about it, but you can engineer all kinds of fascinating three-body physics. That's also a part of the topic of this workshop, people working on few-body physics or three-body physics, where you can tune, because you can tune these scattering lengths, you can tune all kinds of interesting and exotic few-body phenomena like these Efimov states and so forth, which I don't have time to describe, but few-body physics is very much a part of this.
As a writer, I'm going to jump to the chase, so what kind of headline can I extract from your talk?
headline, okay.
I didn't notice you didn't use the word entangled.
I didn't use the word entangled. That's because we haven't quite got there yet. There are people here who are, I think, thinking about these kind of things. That in fact, if taking these, they already can put these in a three-dimensional lattice. It's only sparsely occupied. It's not fully occupied.
Just how to extract headlines from our stuff.
Headlines?
No, I am talking about the
writer. Oh.
That's definitely true, and you might even find some controversy over whether people think it'll ever be here. But that's we are making progress. Yes.
Aside from the complication, what other applications are
you looking at? One thing would be to use the molecules to study interesting chemical dynamical phenomena. We're actually having a talk on coal resonances and coal collisions tomorrow from an experimentalist. The ability to put the molecules in lattices and control these dipole-dipole interactions and study many-body physics is very much on the minds of the experimentalist and the theorist working in the area. It just hasn't happened yet because the field is still developing experimentally. So we can't give any say they've done this. I mean, Jun Yi would love nothing better than to take 100 KRB molecules sitting in some lattice and show that the spins are doing some entangled dance or maybe doing some interesting many-body phenomena. They're very much trying to get there. And of course, part of the things workshops like these to try to figure out, okay, it's hard. What can they do with what they've got? Can we take realistic molecules that we've got now and got them in the lab? Can we learn how to make them dance to our tune? You know, that's the headline. Yes, can we make molecules dance to our tune? Okay, there we go. Dances with molecules. There you go, okay, come on.
What are the challenges or prospects for coal
anti-atoms,
coal?
That's a you mean real antimatter?
Yeah.
It was interesting that Bill Phillips and I, along with someone else at NIST back in 1986 or 87, I think, put in a proposal to the NIST director for doing Lyman alpha cooling of hydrogen with the intent of doing Lyman alpha cooling of anti-hydrogen. Now, it actually never went anywhere. It wasn't successful. But so not everything works, you know. But yes, I think it would be possible. There are people using laser cooling and trapping techniques to work with exotic isotopes, not necessarily antimatter, but maybe some isotope that's not very abundant. And you can do some amazing things with very trace isotopes and things like that. So antimatter, it's awful hard to get a few atoms of molecules and to get them to match them to this kind of, I think Jerry Gabriels at Harvard is probably would love to do something. You may know something about that.
Yeah, well, in the mid-80s,
yes.
Huge.
Okay.
In fact, I had several workshops with the idea of trying to
Okay, and use laser cooling. Yeah, I mean, look, you can. This is a cooling method and a trapping method. So if the antimatter you have is in some way commensurate with these kind of techniques, then sure. I mean, people, but it's hard.
That's all.
Sure. Mm-hmm.